So I'm talking about program integration and our experience in Wisconsin. And like everyone else, unfortunately, nothing to disclose. Not basking in any money from anything right now. So what I'm going to talk about today is briefly a little overview of what our structure is in Wisconsin and our approach to program integration. Then I think we'll move into some of the more important things about lessons that we learned from this project, and hopefully you can all learn from our mistakes if you want to be doing more program integration within your states. And then some of the major successes that we think we've accomplished thus far with program integration. And briefly, as had been mentioned, there are a variety of different structures for the variety of different health departments, and we wanted to get some background context when we're talking about departments and bureaus and things like that. So our government structure starts at the top with the governor, then we have our departments under the governor. We're the Department of Health Services, and then within those are divisions, and we're the Division of Public Health. Within the division, there are bureaus, and we're the Bureau of Community Health Promotion, where most of the program integration stuff lies. And then there's the individual sections where the programs, such as tobacco, obesity, chronic disease, and maternal and child health, that's where they reside. So why integrate? And I think this has been covered a little bit in some of the previous presentations, but as we all know, chronic diseases share common root causes and their common risk factors. So if we can address all those at the same time, we can probably be more effective at addressing chronic diseases. And then also having one chronic condition may put an individual at risk for having another. So if someone is diabetic, they also have issues potentially. They might have gotten there from obesity or something else. So there are cross links among all the programs that they could be covering the same populations with the different diseases. So underlying principles, wanted to make sure not to do any harm to those underlying categorical programs. We wanted to make sure that the great work that has already been developed in those programs still have solid footing. And if only we'd gone before North Carolina, I could have said that they stole this from us, but no, they went before us. And honestly, we did see this at one of the early program integration meetings of the states that North Carolina had put up about wanting to create that organizational culture where program integration is the norm. And so we kind of co-opted that as well. We think that's just a really good concept and a good thought. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't just create a buzzword of integration, but it actually meant something. It was actually a new way of doing business and not just a catchphrase. So we started out by using what we already had existing in the division. We had a program integration work group that had been meeting for many years before this formal project went into place. And it represents a life course approach, and we think that's a great way to sort of approach this whole idea of integration as well. And then all of the states that participated in this pilot received a visit from the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors State Technical Assistance Review, or STAR, team. And we used that as our basis in Wisconsin for how we wanted to develop our integrated work plan. And then we had a variety of meetings to make sure to go from generals to more specifics as to what we wanted to try to accomplish. And from that evaluation, there were six key elements that sort of popped up of things that we either needed to work on or that we had strengths in that we should further develop. So looking at those there, and one to highlight is evaluation, which as I'm sure you all know, at the state level, you're lucky enough to have the resources to get the program going. It's kind of an afterthought sometimes to do the evaluation, and yet that is a very important thing to see, are the things that we're doing effective. So wanting to make sure that we built in some good evaluation into this project. And then we have a variety of different levels of management and leadership throughout this project. We have our core team, which is our bureau director, myself, program integration work group leads, and then program leads for obesity and tobacco. And they were picked initially because a lot of the projects that we were starting to work on with the program integration kind of dealt with those two areas. And then we have what we call our core team plus, which is all of those people in the core team, and then we also add the individual program leads into that group. And then, as I said, our existing program integration work group, that one of the unique things about this is that it draws not just from the traditional chronic disease areas, but also from maternal and child health, environmental health, and we had this in place a long time before this pilot project came into place. So we wanted to make sure, because the pilot project didn't necessarily include these areas specifically, we wanted to make sure that those people didn't feel that they were getting the boot and getting pushed out of this project. We wanted to make sure to keep them involved very strongly. And so basically, I put this slide up to show that we wanted to not just be a, not just have this be a process, but to have this actually have some great impact on our outcomes. And so we put together a logic model for what we thought program integration was going to get us within 7 to 10 years. And a lot of it looks at the health system, reducing risk factors, looking at healthy lifestyles and how we can support that, improving health equity, getting funding, which is always very important for what we have, maximizing the resources that we do have to their full potential, and then kind of making sure that people are working together to institutionalize that kind of that sense of collaboration and integration. So we did have some early success, buy-in from upper-level management, program leads. We did a quick survey after we just started the project, and about 96% of people there felt that they could understand what their role was and communicate it to others as to how they fit into this. And then we created some ad hoc subcommittees, sort of like the communities of practice, where they're addressing specific areas of the work plan. And so we'll move into a little bit of lessons learned. And one big overall lesson learned is that integration isn't just something that you just do one day and then it's done. It's really a continuous work in progress, and it's a definite process of learning to do things a little bit differently. And again, creating that, it's important to get that organizational culture where this has become sort of the norm, so people feel like this is the way business will be done and not just a sort of an extra project that just takes them away from their real work that they're working on. And we had to have champions that would model the way, especially at upper levels. Like, for example, our bureau director was right out in front on a lot of this and making sure to coordinate the activities and get that, set the tone for the fact that this was something that was really important to our bureau and to the way that we were going to be doing business. And then also having people realize that they may have to give up something in order to gain something more for the whole. It's not going to be exactly the same way we used to do business, but we're going to have a greater effectiveness and ability to achieve our goals if we can work together more efficiently. And then also one thing we realized afterwards was we'd started this process and everyone was involved from the beginning, but then when new people came on board, they didn't necessarily know, you know, what we had done so far, and they hadn't had the history of that. So I think one very important thing is to make sure that when new people come on board, we already have some kind of orientation to this process for them available. Communication, it's been said before, but just as communication can't be done enough, I don't think it can be emphasized enough that communication is very key to this process. I need people to be motivated and keeping their eyes on the ultimate goal of what's going on here. And there will still be some turf issues, but making sure that people don't feel threatened in their individual programs as well. And then again, yes, this does add a little bit of work, and there are some reprioritization of other assignments that has to be done, so people have to kind of know that up front. And this just kind of shows we have, I'm not going to go through each one of these meetings, but this shows that we have those different levels of leadership and management and a variety of different regularly scheduled meetings to kind of keep everyone on track and keep that communication going. And I think it really helped us to have that well-established program integration work group, sort of understanding how everyone kind of fits together a little bit even before this process started. And also, I think that it included the things like maternal and child health and other programs which added value, which weren't necessarily chronic disease specifically. And we did have some issues with that where we would say this is a chronic disease integration, and people who weren't necessarily in a traditional chronic disease field would feel like they were kind of being left out by that term, but we didn't really mean that. Our definition of chronic disease broadened to include all of these different areas as well. We think following that life course model really helps to foster the program integration across the different programs as well. But it's still difficult to get those program budgets to come out of their siloed areas and start to joint fund different projects. And again, can't communicate too much. I said it again. I'll do it. It's very important. People, even when we felt we were communicating, there were people felt they were left out at different times. So it's you can, if when in doubt, communicate more often than not. And you need to say things over and over again, make sure it's heard and absorbed. And then the ARA and the Affordable Care Act, they kind of came in there at the time we were doing a lot of these projects and sort of took a little bit of time away from the program integration communication. But I think, you know, there are also things that are helping to really build up our organization as well. And then it's important that we have that regular communication with CDC to make sure we're on track and with the other integration states that have been kind of piloting this project. As far as partnerships, getting the right partners at the table, it takes time and effort to make sure that we are addressing all the correct partners. But I think as we've done our program integration efforts, we've been very focused on some of the internal partnerships and kind of getting those in line. And then as we have some of these more federal, these new grants, the ARA and other activities that have kind of helped us to move beyond those internal partners and look at some external partners as well. So I think as far as our integrated work plan, I think that the plan really helped people to think together, but then they can still opt to function independently, so still keep their individual identities, but see those areas within that within that work plan where there's a chance to merge and to kind of combine forces and work on different projects. And so it's within that work plan, then people can identify their specific roles within the work plan and how they're working together, but also they feel that sense of responsibility for their part of the project as well. But then I guess on the flip side of that, the final authority can be kind of mixed, and then it you need to make sure to have a very clear idea of who's doing what, or else you could have the situation where there isn't one clear leader for something and it kind of falls apart. So as far as the evaluation, it's important to have the resources to conduct the evaluation. That was the one part of this project that was funded, fortunately, every year to have some evaluators funded to look at the work that we were doing, and it's very important to have the resources set aside for that. Although we had to do that by contracting our evaluation services with an outside partner, our University of Wisconsin, where we have a strong relationship. But the unfortunate thing with that is it doesn't really build the capacity within the health department. But it really was a good way for us to get that going. And I think as you're doing any evaluation with all the surveys that come out, it can be difficult to get people to participate because there are so many different things coming and people think, oh, I thought I answered that one. No, that was the other one. And, you know, there's a variety of different surveys that people need to look at. So we'll kind of finalize here with some major successes that we've had with program integration pilot. Don't want to be all a downer about all the things we did wrong and the lessons learned. I think this has been a great process and we've really accomplished some great things that I don't think we could have accomplished without this pilot project. And one of those is the development of this Healthy People at Every Stage of Life framework. It's just kind of our communication tool that's overarching for the entire bureau and for all other areas that kind of fall within the chronic disease area. And I think this really helps to lead to improved consistent messaging across the bureau, helps us when we're talking with other partners as well. So it really is important to have those integrated messages. And we've got basically, you can see we've got a variety of different areas across the lifespan. So starting strong at birth, and then growing safe and strong, and achieving healthy independence into adolescence, living a healthy, productive, and satisfying life into adulthood, living better longer, and then a variety of messages for each of those areas throughout. So planning ahead, eating well, being active, breathing well, being safe, achieving mental wellness. So I didn't fill those in there, but basically, like as an example, being active, starting strong with tummy time, and then active play, watching less TV, getting a regular exercise program. So sort of, you know, moving throughout the life cycle and keeping these messages intact. So we have good familiarity, and I think people bought into this really well. Most said it was fairly easy to use. They see the value of it, and then it kind of helps people to really think outside the box and work better together. One other thing that we've put together, similar to what North Carolina has talked about, is an integrated risk factor report. And this brought together epidemiologists from a number of different categorical programs and shares different data sources. And it's basically what we're looking at is a policy document. And I don't know if you can see in the back, but basically the subtitle is Why It Matters to the Economy and What You Can Do to Help. Kind of doing the reframing of the public health message so it's not just, you know, we're doing good, we're helping people, because a lot of times that message doesn't really resonate with government. A lot of times we want to see, well, what's the return on investment? What are you really going to do that is going to impact our budget and our bottom line? So that's what this document is trying to do, and trying to make the case that, that chronic diseases do have a great return on investment, and putting money into them will help, and in the long run will actually help the economy of this state. And then finally, this, by working together a little bit more closely and finding those connections, it has helped to pursue some jointly funded opportunities, and you can see them there with a variety of different programs. And then finally, as the ARRA opportunities came along and the Affordable Care Act, we found that we were really very well situated to address those and to put together applications in that short time period that was required, because we'd kind of had everyone already pulled together and thinking about these kinds of things. So it really helped us as we were looking to put forth applications for those, and I think we've been very successful for that reason, and we wouldn't have been as successful, I don't think, without this project. And with that, great, we'll move on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to ask the four speakers to come up. That way we can alternate on the microphone if we have questions, and we can just stand up here and hang out. So come on up. Would you join me again in thanking the panel for their presentations today? I'd like to open this up for questions, and this could be to anyone or collectively. So what's on your mind regarding this work? Yes, sir.
I have two questions, actually. First, thanks all of you. I want to thank all of you for your presentation. That's great. I'm in the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. We were recently funded to do program integration across our infectious disease programs. That's why I'm here. And I wanted to know if any of you had shared best practices with other divisions in your health departments, or if you consider doing that in the future. And the second question, are there any data integration issues or barriers that you've had, and how have you dealt with those?
Great question.
we've had several.
You want to come to the mic, please?
Oh, sure.
We've been approached by several other divisions within the health department to learn about integration, so there does appear to be a lot of interest. Can you say more about your data question?
So our program now focuses on HIV, tuberculosis, and hepatitis, and we're all on different data systems, and we'll have an epidemiologist to help work with you matching across those four different systems. But I'm wondering if in front of the team, there's per program a different data collection system, and if there's been issues matching across those systems to better target services for common risk populations.
We primarily use the BRFIS as our primary data set, and so what we've been able to do is not fight over questions as much, so we've been able to pick the questions that align more closely with the interventions that we're doing, and so we've actually been able to sit down for the first year, time ever, and come up with a five-year data collection plan, so again, we don't have to spend so much time and resources every year fighting over who gets what questions on the BRFIS and whose turn it was last year and all that kind of stuff. So, and then just, all the categorical programs have to report to CDC on different MIS systems, and under the integration pilot, Colorado has opted not to do that, so.
Thank you. Please. So on the data side in Massachusetts, there, I would say, probably this is the case everywhere. At the same time that we're doing this integration pilot, there are other efforts to make our departments work more effective anyway. So, when I presented, I talked about things that we're doing, but under our commissioner, there's a lot more that's happening. So on the data, efficiency, streamlining data reporting is one of those efforts. And within the infrastructure grants that we've just gotten through health reform, there will be a larger effort. Some other examples of more collaborative data efforts that we've used beyond coming together to say which BRFSS questions we would all agree we'd want to look at annually as our core set of chronic disease indicators. We're acknowledging the limitations of BRFSS to tell us what we need to know about the communities that we're trying to serve. So within that, we've had staff getting increased training on the use of GIS, for example, so that we can use other ways of assessing community assets and needs. So that's one. To respond to your question about the infectious disease work, once again, if we use something like H1N1 as an example, no longer is an epidemic just in the purview of the infectious disease section. So our work on H1N1 included school health and school-based health centers and the diabetes program and everybody else who needed to have a piece of what it was going to take to educate the public and get people vaccinated. So that would be my response for you. Okay.
Another question.
Yes.
We've actually tried to work more with our community health center so that we can refer people out, and we've tried to, well, that's about the extent of that, with community health centers, and then there's some free clinics that we also are now accessing a database so that we can try to put that resource on people's websites so that they can access that. Probably not. And there's a lot of competition between the local health departments and the community health centers. Despite our attempts to get them to work together, they still see each other as competitors. So apparently there's not enough sick people for everybody.
I had to say something because I'm from Massachusetts and I can stand here and say what you've heard before, which is that health insurance doesn't mean access, and so I don't know anybody who has universal coverage anyway, and that even in our state, which can now boast having almost 98% of the population insured, there's still that other 2%, and then there are all the people who have insurance with high copay that they still can't afford to get what they want. So in addition to, or what they need actually, in addition to the community health center work, I just wanted to mention that our CDC-funded breast and cervical cancer prevention program and then the WISE Women program for cardiovascular risk reduction is continuing to meet the needs of underinsured women in addition to those who can't be insured, so the people we don't talk about, like the undocumented. And it's through those programs, especially with the community health center support, that they will still have access to coverage.
Great. Another question. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Holly Wolf from the Colorado School of Public Health, and thanks for staying for the meeting. I was interested in what you might have done as far as training your workforce within your departments, divisions, or whatever, so that they were prepared to make change. And I would, in terms of orienting that question in the private sector, if you're going to go through a major change, you spend some time talking to people about what are normal emotions, how they're going to feel as all of this has happened. And I'm just interested in terms of what your programs may have done in terms of building that capacity and flexibility and reorienting what's going on.
Well, I can say in general in Wisconsin, and I don't know if this is the situation you have in a lot of other health departments as well, but when the new governmental leadership comes into place, there are a lot of these different reorganizations and restructures. So I think people are kind of used to the idea that the periodically things have to change and we restructure a little bit. So I think from that aspect, I think people understand, that sometimes these things occur. But I think for us, what we were doing when selling this was more looking at trying to promote the benefits to the programs and the benefits and what we were going to see coming out of this versus just this is a new way of doing things, you're going to have to kind of adapt to it. More so getting people directly involved and saying here's a new way of accomplishing the goals that we want to accomplish and maybe more efficiently and sort of just making sure to have good buy-in and soliciting input from a variety of different individuals from the start.
And we did bring in 2006 when we did that, we did bring in an organizational consultant and did several you know, group presentations on change and managing change and the stages of change and all that kind of stuff. So we did spend a fair amount of time on that early on so people could understand exactly what you're talking about, that it can be bumpy and everybody has feelings and all, so.
Back in the back, yes?
Thanks, this was a great session. I heard all of you talking about this being a very iterative process, doing realignments, course correction, reorging, restructure, trying to make it, you know, as a process to get better. And I just, my question is, my two questions are, one is, how did you minimize confusion among your partners, maybe county health departments, for instance, and the program people there about who it is they should be talking to? Or conversely, how did you empower all the people in your different branches and divisions to feel confident that they could speak on behalf of maybe a program that they're not necessarily being funded through?
One of the things that we had to acknowledge is that our communities and our community partners are farther ahead of us than we are. And I had on one of my slides that part of, you know, in creating the urgency or a case for change is that we were getting enough feedback that we got in the way sometimes more than were actually helpful. So that helped. In terms of having people speak for one another, I think our relationships with partner organizations like the Heart Association, the Massachusetts Public Health Association, also helped. They were reinforcers for us because we talked about integration. We talked about, you know, being on this journey, and, you know, the destination was ultimately going to make us more effective. But then they asked us about it. People would schedule meetings with us and say, how is it going? So at the same time that the Heart Association was no longer just talking about, you know, heart disease risk factors, but talking about all the common risk factors, we were doing the same thing. So I want to believe that the dialogue is happening. And I also want to believe that the ongoing focus on policy and environmental change is getting us all talking the right way also.
Our healthy community COP grew up because the health directors, we have 86 health departments covering the 100 counties, and the health directors had come to us and said, we're tired of y'all coming in and you're not coordinated and you have different systems and we don't understand what the different rules are. Could y'all please make it better? So that was why we have a healthy community COP, because they asked for that. And now we coordinate across. I mean, that's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was. And for speaking for each other, what we've done with our communication and education COP, the new one that's just been created, their first charge is to create a mantra for our CDI section, so that if you're asked, you can say what the priorities are for the section that include everybody and not just what you were interested in.
And one of the just practical things we did is we created one website where all the issues, we don't even call them programs, all the issues are on that same website, and then the contact people for those issues is also listed. And I think in our case, we've done enough of the planning work together that I do think people either feel comfortable being able to talk at a high level about what's going on in that program or know who that person should talk to and can help facilitate that connection.
Any other questions? Any other comments from the panel? Well, thank you again for joining us. This has been great. Let's tell the folks again, thank you.